A lot of movies claim to be about the American dream, but Minari really is. It's about a Korean-American family who moves to Arkansas in the 1980s to follow their father's dream of becoming a farmer.
The grind of trying to make the farm a success strains the parents' marriage and often confounds the kids. It's a story about the choices families make and the ways they try to stay together. I'm Glenn Weldon.
And I'm Linda Holmes, and today we're talking about Minari on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I love this movie, I'm just going to say. Here with me and Glenn from his home in Los Angeles is Tobin Lau, an editor at This American Life. Hi, Tobin.
Hello.
And also joining us is features writer for New York Magazine and Vulture, E. Alex Jung. Hi, Alex. Welcome back.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So I have struggled at times to describe Minari other than by saying how much I love it, because it's sort of not driven by a conventional step-by-step plot, but it's also not a, I don't want to give the impression that it's like a Shapeless tone poem or something like that. It is a portrait of this family at this very difficult moment when they've just come to Arkansas from California. The mom is working while the dad tries to get the farm going. And then grandma, who the kids don't know well, arrives from Korea and kind of presents to them the opportunity to connect with extended family right at this time when everybody's trying to get used to this new place. It stars Steven Yeun as the dad, Jacob, Yeri Han as the mom, Monica, Alan Kim and Noelle Kate Cho as the kids, David and Anne, and my personal MVP, Yajung Yoon as grandma. It was written and directed by Lee Isaac Chung. Boy, I love this movie. Tobin, what did you think?
I also loved this movie, and I actually found myself to be really surprised by it. This might be an unhelpful thought to start with, but I had sort of like a meta experience with it, where something about my brain or my experience is when I watch a movie that is about a POC family moving to the Midwest or the South, I found myself having like a low-level panic throughout this movie of like, when is whiteness going to enter the picture in this really catastrophic way? And so I kind of couldn't let go of that. And then towards the middle and the end of the film, when it dawned on me like, oh, this film is really mostly concerned with just this family, just this experience that they have together. It was sort of this revelation and like this easing of the shoulders of like, oh, wow. Isn't this extraordinary? And damn it, like that sucks that this is extraordinary. But I really fell in love with the intimacy of this film and the fact that it was really just concerned with this Korean American family. And that was enough. Their story was enough and how they related to each other was enough. So that was the first thing that really struck me and that I really fell in love with.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's not that the idea that they are in a very white place for the most part doesn't come up.
Right.
But it's not the driving dynamic of the movie. Alex, what did you think?
You know, I feel like I'm concerned with this idea of what is Asian American art a lot. I've often felt dissatisfied by the answers that have come out of, you know, television or popular culture or Hollywood in the past 20 or so years. But, you know, I think with this and Lulu Wang's The Farewell, there is this very clear sense of self that both films have that felt insistent about who they are, but in a kind of gentle way. Like, it wasn't really, I think to your point, Tobin, like whiteness kind of intrudes into the piece, but it doesn't define it. It's not thinking about itself under this gaze and how they react to it. It's really just about being itself and telling its own sort of narrative. And white people are a part of that narrative, but they don't define that existence. And I sort of find the choice even just to do a Korean language film that is an American movie and an American narrative to be a really bold choice, even though it's a quiet film in so many ways.
Yeah, it's interesting because like I said in the intro, it's kind of common for movies to be pitched as American dream type of movies. And often that's like the very conventional kind of rags to riches, blah, blah, blah. And I think this is a film that, like you say, is an incredibly American movie, partly because you see how much Jacob, the dad, believes in this idea that he's going to go to Arkansas and start this farm. And he has this idea about what it means to be successful as a farmer in Arkansas that I think is a very, it felt honest to me.
Yeah, I really want to pick up on that because from the basic plot description, from the trailers, from the press materials, you might get a sense that the arc of this film is familiar, but it keeps undercutting scene by scene. It keeps defying and complicating what the film's broad outlines are about in a really smart and satisfying way. This is, on one level, a film you've seen before about a stubborn father who places his dreams of independence over the needs of his family because he's more concerned about that macho crap of being a breadwinner and being a provider than being a caregiver. That is super familiar. It crosses cultures. But a very interesting thing happens when you cast Steven Yeun as the dad, as Jacob. All those familiar story beats, all the bad choices the dad makes are turned on their head because Jacob remains, to me anyway, so sympathetic in this film. He is so emotionally available, even when the character himself is striving not to be, which is remarkable on one sense because the film squarely places our sympathies on Monica because Yeti Han is doing so much more than just being the concerned mom, you know, hand-wringing. She's a real flesh-and-blood, three-dimensional character. And this happens throughout the film. The grandma is on one level a kooky old lady with life lessons to teach, but she's so much more than that. The kid is, yes, a cute POV character, but the film allows him to be, a word I can't use on an NPR podcast, I'll just say a jerk, a real jerk, in the way the kids are jerks. They're little self-centered little sociopaths. The locals, as you guys mentioned, are ignorant, but they're not caricatures. And even the very, very squirrely farmhand, played by Will Patton, has this surprising central decency. So if you think about the broad outlines of the plot, I guarantee you, you haven't seen this before, done in such a really well-executed way that this is a theory. I suspect that is an outgrowth of its autobiographical nature because it's drawn from life, which is messy and doesn't follow character arcs, as opposed to a purely invented narrative, which is often schematic and overdetermined, just cleaner, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you mentioned grandma who shows up and you sort of think she's going to be like the kooky old grandma who, like you say, has life lessons and whatever. And especially when she shows up and it's like, you're not like a regular grandma. You swear and are fun and hang out on the floor and play with us and say like kind of mouthy things back to this. I mean, one of the things that happens is this little, like, as you say, jerk kid learns that grandma will sling kind of back and forth this behavior back and forth with him in a way that I think on the one hand really appeals to him. And on the other hand, he just finds kind of disorienting. But she is such a, I think it's such a lived in performance as grandma. So you get such a warm and kind of complete person. And, you know, the promotion for the film has often said, you know, everybody's lives are shaken up when grandma comes to stay with them. And it's true, but not in the way that, like, grandma does not serve a specific function. Like, dad and kids don't get along. Grandma shows up and mends that relationship. Or, you know, mom and dad's marriage is disintegrating and grandma shows up and fixes it. She's not functional in that way. It's just an important part of that family dynamic. And like I said in the intro, I just love, like, being with this family at this really difficult moment for them. Because I don't know if I agree with Glenn that the film comes down quite as hard on Monica's side. I think I felt for both of them. Like, I felt for his desire to have something of his own, as well as her sort of concern about where that was going to leave the family.
So I love Yoon Ye-jung. She is an absolute legend in Korean cinema, really, and TV. I will have a profile with her in New York Magazine coming out, so look out for that.
Amazing.
You know, like, to me, the relationship that really struck me was the one between her, Sunja, the grandmother, and then the little kid, David, because they are at odds in so many ways, but yet she's the one who really sees him, I think, right? Like, she is the one who actually takes to the environment the best, I would say. She explores it. She is excited by it. And then she finds a place to grow something, which is this plant, Minari, which is what the movie is named after, that she knows can thrive here. And that's obviously how she sees her grandson. And that's something his parents can't really see. And that's like, that relationship just struck me as incredibly beautiful and lyrical.
One of the big things I walked away from this film thinking is just like, I hope in the buzz of awards that is starting to circle the film that I don't see as much love for Yidi Han sort of in the, like, the actors that are named. And I really walked away from this film blown away by, you know, everyone in the cast, but I was really blown away by her performance. I thought it required so much nuance and so many levels. And I found her to be, in a lot of ways, like the heart of the film. So I just am here on my personal soapbox that as that starts to build up, I hope she is included in the awards chatter and the recognition chatter.
I would want to second that.
Yeah. It's so hard for that character not to come out as like the wife who doesn't believe in him or the wife who doesn't support him. And it's so, she's so sympathetic in the sense that you completely understand like where she's coming from at all times. Glenn, do you agree?
Absolutely. That's why I think maybe my sympathy was located squarely with her because she's doing such a great job. Mm-hmm. My only quibble, and it's super petty, is, look, I don't begrudge the filmmakers finding a central metaphor as powerful as this one. Minari is the plant that is tough enough to survive anywhere. I mean, if you're a writer and you come across that metaphor, especially to fit this story, which is about growing Korean vegetables, like, it would be impossible to let it go. That said, making it the title points all kinds of arrows at it, where it's such a part of the texture of the story. And it works so well. It would be one part of this great story that becomes the thing that's like every time it's mentioned, it's like beep, 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 beep that I just thought, you know, why call it that when sexing the chickens is right there waiting for you?
It's true. For those of you who do not know anything about sexing chickens, that is the job that they've both done, that both parents have done. The mom is still doing it while the dad's working on the farm. It's just picking up the little chicks and literally trying to see what sex they are. It's hard work. And that's another thing I think I admired about it is that although they spend so much time on kind of trying to get this farm started, there's also a lot of, I think, respect for the fact that what the mom is doing is super important to the family, and also that she's working to try to get faster and get better, not because she loves doing it, but because she's trying to become as able as possible to do this job and keep the job and support the family, whereas the husband has always kind of been known, Jacob has always kind of been known as a super fast chicken sexer.
I don't necessarily think the film asks you to root against the dad or find problem with what his motivations are. Like, if anything, it made me think a lot about, like, the cost of the American dream and the selling of the American dream and sort of what is promised and what people go after as a result of that. So I guess one of the things I liked and we've been pointing at is, like, the film doesn't sort of have a moral or like a morality play about, you know, whose side you're on or not. It's sort of just like you understand where everyone's coming from and sort of the cost of that and also like how it plays out in this family.
Yeah, and that's exactly my point. I mean, like the broad description of dad relocates family because he wants to be a farmer, like that, if you just find that, there is an implicit value judgment there and there is not in this film because it's a much more nuanced approach.
Right.
Or it could, I mean, it could turn into like the Mosquito Coast or whatever,
exactly.
You know, where the family is being, you know, the family is having to follow around dad on his different ideas. And it's not that movie at all. It's not, I agree with Glenn, it's not that at all for, among other reasons, all the reasons Tobin's talking about. Well, let us know what you think about Minari. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. Welcome to banking reimagined. Capital One checking and savings accounts have no fees or minimums and a top-rated banking app that lets you manage your money anytime, anywhere. Check on the account balance, deposit checks, pay bills, and transfer money on the go. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A., member FDIC.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc is here for you with 24/7 access to board-certified doctors who can diagnose and treat non-emergency conditions like sinus infections, allergies, rashes, and more. And Teladoc's doctors can, where authorized, call in a prescription to be filled at the pharmacy of your choice. Download the app today or visit teladoc.com/NPR.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week. What's making us happy this week? Tobin Lau, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is a little specific and very gay. If anyone is a Drag Race fan, you may know that there's an American season going on right now, but there's also a UK season going on.
Yes, there is.
And the most recent episode truly had the anthem of our time, which is UK Hun.
Oh, Tobin.
But the actual, like, lyric hook of it is bing, bang, bong, sing, sang, song, ding, dang, dong, UK Hun.
Bing, bang, bong, sing, sang, song, ding, dang, dong, all these people strut so bad, it must be illegal. C-A-Y-C-E, what? Inch to the floor, I ain't talking about my weeds.
It has been going through my head this entire week in a way that might be annoying usually, but right now I'm so happy for it. And it just brings me joy every time I catch myself, like in the kitchen or whatever, just going, bing, bang, bong, sinks. Like it just, ding, ding, it brings me so much happiness. It's so stupid. It's so good. I love it so much. So my what's making me happy is UK Hun.
You're F right. It's so stupid. It's so bad. Oh my God, Troman, it's terrible. It's a terrible, terrible song.
We found the true topic of this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, Glenn and Tobin debate UK Hun. All right. Thank you very much, Tobin Lowe. Alex Jung, what's making you happy this week?
You know what? That was my second choice as I was running through things to do.
There you go.
And I decided I would be literate this week.
Mistake. Mistake.
I just regained my capacity to read books recently, and I started reading and just finished Tori Peters' debut novel, Detransition Baby. You know, it's a novel about three women, two trans, one who has detransitioned to being a man, and then a cis woman, and the three of them living in New York and debating these questions around motherhood, identity, gender, all of these things, and what it means to be a woman who has it all. And it draws a lot from Sex and the City, and I think that at its peak, it kind of has that like fun, frothy, but also high stakes energy around, you know, what it means to be a woman, and I quite enjoyed reading it. But otherwise, yes, watch Drag Race UK.
Definitely, yeah. We can agree on that.
Thank you very much, Alex. Again, that's Detransition Baby by Tori Peters. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
All right, look, this one's going to be predictable. The final 58 seconds of the seventh episode of WandaVision on Disney Plus, and that episode is called Breaking the Fourth Wall, is what's making me happy this week. I won't get into precisely what it entails because many folks aren't caught up, but I will say that it's not the reveal that those final seconds contain, because some of us saw that coming through the midday snow. No, it is the achingly precise execution of it, the comic timing of it, the music that really sells it, and mostly the largely wordless performance at its center. Has that been playing on a loop on my phone and on my laptop and in my head for the past 5 days as we tape this? Yes, it has. The fact that the gays are trying to make UK Hun happen like it's fetch when this thing exists in the world is just surprising to me. Shocking.
Wow, rude.
Homophobic, really.
So I'd be fool to say, and an arrant fraud to say, that it hasn't been in my head. I wasn't really sold in the episode preceding it, except for Elizabeth Olsen's performance, which is amazing, but a lot of faffing around in that episode. But that last minute of WandaVision episode 7 should be blasted with a fire hose of Emmys, as far as I'm concerned. That thing is perfect.
Have you heard the mashup of the moment you were talking about and UK Hun? Because it exists.
Oh. You just got ruined for Glenn. The whole thing just got ruined for Glenn.
The internet is a beautiful and terrible force. It's
true. Yes.
It is. It must be contained.
Well, thank you, Glenn Weldon, for reminding us of your catchy tune of the week. What is making me happy this week? I ran out of television about a week and a half ago, and so I was so desperate that I started reading books. I have read a whole bunch of books, many of which are not coming out for a while, but one of which you can read right now, and it's by Alicia Rye, and it's called First Comes Like. She has written these really charming romances that are like tech adjacent. There's one of them in this series is about a woman who runs a dating app. They all have women of color as their heroines, but mostly I just love them because she writes just very sparkly, funny, extremely readable romances. This one is about a woman who's a YouTuber, and she gets these messages from this guy who's a famous Bollywood actor. And so they're corresponding, and she wants to go meet him. And he comes from this like Bollywood royalty family. And then, you know, complications ensue, as they do in this type of book. And I found it to be just super charming. It hit the spot when I'd been doing a bunch of like super heavy reading. This is just exactly the fizzy, bubbly story that I was looking for. So Alicia Rye's First Comes Like, and basically anything by her And that is what is making me happy this week. That brings us to the end of our show. If you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations exclusive to the newsletter, it's my baby, subscribe to that at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. You can also find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at Linda Holmes. You can find Glenn at GH Weldon. Tobin is at Tobin Lowe. And you can follow Alex at @E_AlexJung. You can find our editor, Jessica Reedy, at @Jessica_Reedy, and our producer, Candace Lim, at @TheCandaceLim. You can find our producer, Mallory Yu, at @Mallory_Yu. You can find our producer, Mike Katziff, at @MikeKatziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now. Thanks so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bing, bang, bong.
And thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. We will see you all next week when we will be recapping this year's Golden Globes.
Here at Planet Money Industries, we've manufactured T-shirts, we've bought oil, we've even gone to space. But our next Planet Money series, well, let's just say a superhero is born. Coming to a podcast feed near you from NPR.